Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 4, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Linda Kraxberger and Jim Flank. On our program this week, how young is too young to publish a child's image when they're charged with a crime? It's a hot topic after a pair of 12-year-olds were charged with stabbing another child this weekend in Wisconsin. Some TV stations and newspapers published images from their first court appearance, while others chose not to. A CNN reporter covering unrest in Turkey is questioned by police and arrested live on the air. And a change in the revenue model at the Columbia Missourian. 18 months after putting day-old content behind a paywall, it'll be accessible to everyone again. But there's a catch. We'll talk about it. There's a lot more that I'm hoping we'll get to as well before the half hour is up, but let's start with the release of Bo Bergdahl. The Taliban captured Bergdahl and held him captive since 2009. Saturday, President Obama, flanked by his parents, announced he'd be coming home.
This morning, I called Bob and Jannie Bergdahl and told them that after nearly 5 years in captivity, their son Bo is coming home. Sergeant Bergdahl has missed birthdays and holidays and the simple moments with family and friends, which all of us take for granted. But while Bo was gone, he was never forgotten.
Bergdahl's release was part of a prisoner swap. In exchange for his release, five Taliban leaders were let go from Guantanamo Bay and returned. That part of the story caught fire quickly, Republicans accusing the Obama administration of negotiating with terrorists, a claim the president denies. But another storyline has reemerged as well. Some of Bergdahl's fellow soldiers say he abandoned his post and deserted the army prior to capture. Here's former soldier Josh Corder talking to CNN's Jake Tapper, voicing his frustration over how many lost their lives trying to rescue Bergdahl.
It's very frustrating to me to turn on the TV and to see Bergdahl's family on the TV being shown to everyone. And then these soldiers, although they had very beautiful and extravagant ceremonies after they died, were pretty much only recognized in the local news, local newspapers. They were never nationally televised for their sacrifices in the way that he is. And he pretty much voluntarily walked away and in turn caused the actions that may have killed them.
Now, when I first saw the announcement Saturday afternoon on TV, my first thought was, this is like that Showtime series Homeland playing out in real life on my TV. But now that we're a few days into it, it's starting to look even more and more like some of those plot lines we saw play out there. What do we know about Bergdahl at this point?
Well, I think officially the Pentagon is saying don't rush to judgment. We don't know whether what the circumstances were by which he might have left his post or was captured. Mm-hmm. And so officially the Pentagon's position is quite different from what many of his comrades who served with him are coming out in the media and saying.
I also think this, like many, many stories, there are things that the administration can tell us and there are things that the administration can't tell us. And if we were privy to all the details, we might know more. I think that we see some things in the military today where maybe 30 years ago, someone who was in the military would never criticize their commander in chief, regardless of the action, regardless of activity. And I think we're seeing that more today under Obama's administration than we have in previous administrations.
We've also seen, again, going to that other storyline of did the Obama administration negotiate with terrorists mm-hmm. to have this happen? And Obama and his spokespeople have come out and said over and over again, we don't leave any man behind. We always make sure we bring everybody home. Is this something that Republicans are just kind of latching onto to turn this into something to play politics with?
Well, I mean, I think there are some concerns. Today we saw a video emerge of a husband and wife, a Canadian and American citizen, who all of a sudden video is now appearing saying that, you know, they are appealing for their release as well. So I think there is certainly a great deal of legitimacy in the whole argument about negotiating with terrorists or not. This is obviously a much more complex issue than just do we negotiate as a nation with terrorists or not. And there are so many different layers to this that depending politically on your affiliation or the expediency of the matter, you're going to seize a storyline and try to carry that for whatever advantage you might see.
And why wouldn't the Republicans do that? I mean, at every opportunity, if there's any opportunity to criticize the Obama administration right now, whether that's a media organization that follows a certain viewpoint or whether that's the Republican Party, you're going to see that regardless of whether this is an international situation or a domestic situation or whatever.
One of the things, though, that seemed to stand out about it was how quickly it happened. There was no real honeymoon period in this news of the only POW in the Afghanistan or the Iraqi wars coming home. That was dinner time Saturday. By the Sunday morning talk shows, the Republicans were already hammering in on this.
I think that's because there are Sunday morning talk shows. if we didn't have, I just think over the last few decades, we've seen a collapsing of the news cycle, and there is no such thing as a honeymoon period anymore, I don't think, on any story.
Well, and there used to be a time when you know, particularly on areas of national security, parties would come together, they'd sort of drop their partisanship. But every opportunity presents itself differently. And as Linda pointed out, you know, we know the Sunday morning talk shows are going. So now we're going to get into a room. We're going to talk about what is our message going to be? What are we going to stay on point with? And then we're going to carry that through.
Okay. Well, we've talked many times on this program about the need for a federal shield law for journalists, something that will allow us to legally protect our sources without fear of being jailed. Well, there's been some mixed messages coming out of Washington this week. The House of Representatives very quietly passed a bill to protect journalists from revealing or identifying sources if subpoenaed. A small victory squashed Monday morning when the Supreme Court refused to take up the case of a New York Times reporter. Attorney General Eric Holder said that when he made a comment last week that no reporter would be jailed for doing their jobs, he wasn't specifically talking about the case of James Rosen. But what do we take from this? So many mixed messages.
I think this is the same as what would happen in any, again, any administration. Somebody, they have a personal belief or they have a belief of what they're going to do. They speak quickly without knowing that that's not what is being requested of them, and then they have to backpedal. And that's what I think is that this is backpedaling after Holder came out very publicly saying we're not going to prosecute.
Well, and particularly he said, as long as I'm attorney general, I'm not going to pursue this. Well, that's his prerogative to say that, but it certainly isn't binding in any court of law and certainly doesn't even align itself with the present interpretation of law.
So let's talk for a second about this case from the New York Times. What is it about this case against James Rosen that federal prosecutors are so adamant about wanting to get him into a courtroom and reveal his sources?
Well, I think this is, PBS came out with its United States of Secrets about NSA and a lot of information in that particular Frontline documentary was about the Obama administration being particularly punishing when it comes to leakers. And they made a distinction between leakers and whistleblowers. And I think this is just, there are certain things that this administration cannot stand or cannot abide by. And there are people's personal personalities that come out in these things. And this is one thing that Obama strikes particularly hard on. And I think this is just a reflection of President Obama's policies that we won't tolerate leaks.
I think there's something telling in the fact that the Supreme Court said we're not going to take this issue up, though, as well. And, you know, Rosen, he detailed a botched CIA effort in the Clinton administration to thwart Iran's nuclear ambitions. I mean, what Rosen did, you know, for a book publication was to basically get some information that ended up being very important from a national security standpoint. Reporters need to understand what shield laws do protect and what they don't protect, and then approach how they tell stories and where they tell stories accordingly.
Well, Lewis Katz has been described as a reluctant newspaper owner. He died along with five others Saturday in a plane crash near Boston. 4 days earlier, he and a partner won an auction to buy the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, and Philly.com for $88 million. He was being looked to as the savior for an embattled newspaper environment in Philadelphia. What do we know about what could happen with this transaction now going forward since he has passed?
Well, what we know is that his son will likely carry the mantle. I mean, I think that's the big takeaway, is that that he did win a protracted battle with a co-owner that he had not gotten along with, and it was well publicized for many years, and that he did believe in the fact that journalism was in a great transition stage, and he wanted to be a major actor in ushering Philly.com and the Philadelphia Inquirer, among a couple of other organizations, through that. So we know he was a champion. We know on a personal level because of who he associated with, but also on a professional level. And for Philly.com, it leaves it in a position where, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, where there is going to be some question mark about how do we carry forward. We thought we had a champion here, I think, and now you have to wonder.
I think there's been so much turmoil. So we had a colleague who was here for several years, who was a temporary faculty member here, who was from the Philly environment. And that is just such an ongoing soap opera. This becomes just yet another chapter. I don't think they're going to have sort of peace and security, particularly in an era of when many newspapers are in an era of managed decline. This is a particularly sad chapter in that, but it's still sad.
Well, and we should note that he paid well above market value to retain the rights to this news organization that is in such a state of transition. And so the fact that he was willing to go so far out despite the economic conditions only lends itself to that storyline.
And can his son really carry on that legacy or not? Will his son have that, that same vision and commitment? Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So this next topic, it's one of ethics, it's one of editorial decision making. How and when do you use the photos of children accused of crimes so heinous that prosecutors charge them as adults? Here's a portion of a report that aired on CNN.
Two 12-year-old girls are accused of inviting their friend to play hide-and-seek after a sleepover, but police say they had much darker intentions.
Once there, one suspect held the victim down while the other suspect stabbed her 19 times in the arms, legs, and torso.
Suspects Morgan Geiser and Anissa Weir, middle school students who appeared in court Monday, allegedly spent months planning the attack on their friend.
So in that clip, you heard the names of the two children who have been charged in this. Our viewers on television or on the internet are also able to see what their pictures look like from that first court appearance. But there's been a lot of debate among journalists, even most recently quite lively in one of our alumni Facebook groups that has gone on in the past 24 hours, about whether or not we should be naming them because they are so young.
I worked for news organizations where there was typically a standard that if the courts had determined that if police or courts had released a name and they had determined that a juvenile would be tried as an adult, that we would use that name on the air. For myself personally, as a journalist, and as a parent, I can't agree with that same standard. There's still a standard of innocent until proven guilty. We don't know what their mental state was. And just because they've been charged as an adult, I can't see that we then, they'll be known in their own community. But being known in your own community versus being known throughout the world and known on the internet is a very different story. They will never have private lives ever again.
Well, and I think part of that is the heinous, nature of the crime. I mean, when you stab another preteen 19 times, that's one standard, is the type of crime committed. And this all becomes this sense of, we discuss these in our newsrooms and say, okay, what are the circumstances by which we protect or don't protect? I think the other thing is, sometimes I think we hold ourselves to a standard when, frankly, children had much less exposure to media than they do now, with much greater supervision, whether it be parental supervision or whether it be the state of the media that didn't allow them the access that they have now. The interesting thing about kids today, and Linda, you're a parent of, yeah. of a teenager. I'm of a teenager who just turned a teenager. The exposure that my kids have now and the things that they know about it, the age at which they know about them. And this is everything from anything that you could try to protect your kids from. It is so much greater now. They have such quick access to it. Many of them have mobile devices. And so to bring that back around, I think when we talk about children committing crimes, there was a time when we thought, well, they're innocent, so we should protect them because maybe they did. Now, I think we have to evaluate those standards and say, because of the exposure that they have now, does that change our evaluation of their suitability to be tried as an adult, to be protected, and all these other, you know, sort of traditional arguments we've had?
Now, one of the things that was interesting, the local media, this happened in suburban Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And from what I noticed in researching the stories, it was really coming together yesterday. Most, if not all, of the local media named and showed the images. Some of the other network affiliates, newspapers in other markets, including here, showed video that maybe didn't mention the names or had the faces blurred out. How does proximity play into this as well?
Well, one of our traditional news values is the closer something is to home, the more newsworthy it is, the more information that you need to know. So if two hikers are killed in Vermont in some set of circumstances that makes it particularly unusual, our local audience geographically don't necessarily care about the names, but they're more interested in the story because of this thing, this odd or unusual thing that happened. In this case, these names will probably stick in people's minds.
Yeah, and I think, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, a novelty is another one of those standards.
Right.
And in this case, you know, and not novelty to make light of, but novelty because it is so strange and so bizarre and heinous. It stands out as a story. And because of that, it also rises in a level of importance. And it strips away, again, some of those protections that I think journalists apply to a child.
So I wasn't yet living here in 2009 when Alyssa Bustamante was accused and then convicted of killing 9-year-old Elizabeth Olton. How might these decisions have been made or different? I mean, everybody here in this market and in parts of the country know and could identify Alyssa Bustamante. She was 15 at the time. There was some discussion in this Facebook group that there's a big difference between 15 and 12 and that somebody might not show the pictures of somebody who was 12 but would who was 15. How does that factor in?
You know, I think they become artificial lines in the sand. At least they do for me personally. And I do believe that it ultimately these are decisions that are made by individual journalists and by individual organizations, and that there probably isn't going to be any sort of universal agreement. That being said, 15, 12, a 12-year-old in one setting is every bit as worldly and aware as a 16-year-old in another. So I think you have to look situationally at it.
Okay. Well, remember last week when we were talking about one of the student newspapers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, choosing not to run any stories on the mass shooting there? Well, it claimed that it was trying not to create or cause any more harm or pain for the victims, their families, or the community. Reporters and editors of that paper caught a lot of heat from other members of the media for that decision, including those of us on this program. Well, the Bottom Lines editorial board, that's the name of the paper, the Bottom Line, issued a statement pretty much recanting the original op-ed and said that it was going to cover the story and do it in a measured, sensitive way. It has begun to do just that, posting a news story the very next day. If you'd like to read the full statement, you can. We've posted it on our links blog at kbia.org. Readers of the Columbia Missourian will soon notice a big change. The paywall that had been blocking content older than 24 hours is coming down, and a new revenue model is going to be taking its place. Linda, as readers, what are we going to see happening when we go to the Columbia Missourian's
so
website?
So this is according to the executive editor at the Missourian, Tom Warover, and he wrote a column to readers that tells us that when you attempt to click on a story, you'll see a bold headline, and if you're you'll have an option to either log in as a subscriber, so there you can still pay and subscribe to the digital edition, or you will be asked if you are willing to answer a short survey. And the survey takes about 10 to 15 seconds to answer, includes one or two questions, and the questions might be something like, the example he gave was, have you considered changing makeup brands? And he said, surprisingly, he has not considered right. that.
But another reader may have.
But another reader may have. So in answering these questions, then this Google product will provide, it receives 10 cents for the survey, and it provides 5 cents back to the newspaper for each set of questions answered.
One of the reasons that this column that Tom Warhover had written said that it was important to make this switch because some of the feedback it had received from readers was that they weren't able to share content mm-hmm. via social media with the paywall that was in place. Jim, talk for a minute about how that may have been holding back yeah. the publication.
Well, sharing is one of the key ways that, I mean, you can talk about viral news, and we all do talk about it, and that is just wildly shared news. But sharing has become such a central value proposition, not just for news organizations, but any organization that is trying to communicate with its audience. And what you don't always know is what's going to get shared, what isn't going to get shared. But in this day and age, where everyone's carrying around mobile devices, the ability to grab hold of a news story at the time that it's happening and get that thing shared is so very important that if you put an impediment in the way of sharing, you have now limited your reach, your effectiveness, your megaphone, whatever you want to call it.
I was actually interviewed by a reporter from KBIA yesterday who was working on a story about this. And one of the things that she asked me is, what do we think or expect the audience's tolerance for the surveys to be? And I know my response at that point was, we don't know that yet. We don't know yeah. where people are, that annoyance factor is going to kick in. But looking at the Missourian's traffic over the course of the last year or 2 years, the 18 months really since mm-hmm. this paywall went into effect, you can see a dip. And when you talk about shareable stories that aren't getting passed on after those 24 hours, think about two of the biggest stories that have happened on this campus in the last 6 months, the Sasha Manoukouri case mm-hmm. and Michael Sam's mm-hmm. coming out. That brings a whole new nationwide or international audience that can begin to consume this content again.
One of the things, this is oddly, I mean, it's related, but it's a sort of sidelight issue. And I have a digital subscription, mm-hmm. but I constantly forget my passwords to things. And so when I get to paywalls and I have to re-enter my password often, I will give up on a story or search for a story in some other way. And this isn't a criticism of the Missourian. This is just my old brain. And so so I was just thinking, my gosh, if I can just answer survey questions and I can get there faster right. than remembering my password, I may opt for this model as opposed to that model.
Well, and the other thing that I would say about this is that I think all news organizations are going to have to look at multiple revenue opportunities and say, okay, paywall may be one because I too am a subscriber to the Missourian. And I like that ability to just be able to get in and read as much as I want mm-hmm. rather than answer a survey every time a new article would pop up. But I will say creativity in terms of finding the value in your particular content and figuring out how to monetize against that. That's our great challenge. I think there are many opportunities to do it, this being one.
And I just think speed and convenience, though, are things that we think people aren't going to pay more for something. Oh, if you've already paid for it. But no, sometimes people are willing to pay twice. It's like, oh, I read this, mm-hmm. but I want to own it or keep it. So I'm willing to pay for an ebook, even though I have already ingested that content in some other way. And so there are things that people are willing to pay a little, an incremental amount more for if it means convenience. And so who knows where that threshold is for this particular model?
Oh, well, watch and see what happens.
See what happens.
Earlier this half hour, we were talking about challenges to press freedom in this country. It's nothing like what reporters face elsewhere. See what happened to this crew covering a protest in Istanbul.
often you get clashes erupting, demonstrators throwing rocks, bottles, and police cracking down with their use of force as well.
Are you journalists?
So, excuse me.
Come here, please. Are you journalists?
We're, I think I'm getting...
Passport, please. Just a minute.
I think we're, I'm being...
Just a minute. May I see your passport,
so,
please? Beach Canal.
CNN.
Can I see your passport?
Okay,
can I see your passport?
Yeah. So, Errol, we're now being checked.
And journalist card. Please, okay, journalist card. Can I see your
card right here? Just anyway, this is my press card. It allows me to...
Where is your passport?
It allows me to work in Turkey.
Where is your passport? Go with me. Where is your passport? Okay.
Takes an incredible amount of composure to continue doing the live shot under those conditions. Has to be scary for the reporter, for the producer was involved there on the ground. The anchor and the producer back at the station, too. I can just imagine, Jim, you spent many years as an anchor. Linda is a producer. You find yourselves either on set or in the booth at that point. What do you do?
Keep rolling.
I was going to say, stay on the air, whatever you do, because he's reporting on this very thing of the intimidation tactics that are going on. And all of a sudden, in a way that you know, the reporter can never describe, all of a sudden it's happening, and you see exactly what the intimidation is like.
I think the rest of the story, though, is good in this sense, because if you're just watching it and you haven't been attuned to this on an ongoing basis, when the reporter writes about it afterward and when different people have written commentary about this, they describe that, in fact, this reporter had never been asked for his passport by police ever before, that he had always used his press credentials and that had never been questioned before. And so it's even more of an example than what you saw on the air, that what you saw on the air looks pretty mild compared to sort of when you put it into context.
Okay. June 4th, 1989. 25 years ago today, students filled Beijing's Tiananmen Square fighting the communist regime. NBC's Tom Brokaw remembers having to get creative in how he brought the story home to American viewers.
I had a very resourceful cameraman by the name of Tony Wasserman from South Africa. We'd covered wars all over the world and uprisings in every corner of the planet. And I went out and he had a bicycle and he was putting a soft drink box on the back. And I immediately said, "We're going to put a camera in there, right?" He said, "Absolutely."
I know this may seem a little unusual, but it's one of the few ways that we can show you life in the streets of Beijing without getting in trouble with the authorities.
We took off not knowing if I was going to get shot or whether they're going to pull this off or not.
So many of the images from that day are going to stay with us forever. The man climbing the tank with the world watching. What have we seen change in China in 25 years?
Well, I think China learned a great deal, fortunately or unfortunately, in the live broadcast that took place. The world learned about the impact of live television news at a major formative moment when I think the world was watching with hope at one point and then saw reality. And I don't think for anyone who witnessed that they won't always remember that.
I think what we learn is that that it's even harder for China today, for the Chinese government today, to keep a lid on things, to keep things bottled up. It's even more difficult. And I wonder if there has been anything learned because we hear and see so much about free speech around the world that is squashed and not allowed to get out. So. Not much of a lesson.
Two, 3 summers ago, I was teaching in Foshan, a city in China, and we were talking about police scanners. And I just remember the awe of everybody in the room that they couldn't believe we could use police scanners and listen to police radios to gather news and to gather information. The idea that the airwaves are free and of the people and that exists. Well, that music means that we're pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to associate producer Hope Kerwin and to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Pat Akers is handling the audio for us. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.